Gourmet coffee coming from your own kitchen, the final frontier. This is the mission of Sparkplug Coffee, who seeks new blends and new methods of distribution. Too boldly, or mildly, they'll cater to your taste, go where no coffee provider has gone before. That's right, the future is now. Sparkplug Coffee starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf, and even a rotating blend for adventurers who like to be surprised. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug even offers autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. And may I add that it is considerably affordable. So get started today. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
Let the Shatner impressions begin.
And action.
Hey, movie friends and lovers, and thank you much for tossing the next 100 project into your ears. Why next? Well, for any newbies, we already did the Top 100 project, and all those podcasts are online anytime. Keep in mind that we spoil movie after movie after movie. I'm the man at the helm of the starship, Ryan Ellis, and here is my co-helmer and wife, Bev.
That's me.
Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. Of the six movies by the original series cast, how many of them earned more than $100 million when you adjust for inflation? All of them? Some of them? None of them?
All of them.
That's right.
Even some of them was quite a margin. Yeah, yeah. Even the ones that everybody hated. I can see why they keep making Star Trek movies.
Yeah, number one was number one. Adjusted, it made $283 million. Then it goes 4, 2, 3, 6, and finally Final Frontier. But even that made $113 million adjusted. Trek is a very popular series, always has been, and probably always will be. I think the only failure in the modern era, at least, would be, what's it called, Insurrection? Is that the one?
Did that fail in the box office? Or was it Nemesis?
Oh, that's the one I'm thinking of.
That's the only one with the Next Generation cast that I've never seen.
I saw it. I think even Generations did fine, and of course, First Contact is a beloved one of the newer cast, we call the Next Generation cast.
Mm-hmm. The three iterations of it now. The three casts, I guess you could say.
And those newest ones have all been big hits. Okay, the next 100 project's 64th film, Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan, was not nominated for either the 1998 or 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. That's not all that surprising. In fact, no Star Trek movie except for this one and I think The Voyage Home were nominated for anything AFI-wise. Paramount released it one day shy of 35 years ago on June 4th, 1982. And as we just discussed, it did very well. It made about seven times its budget. Not a big budget at all, compared to the first movie especially. Anyway, Bev, explain the movie, even though people probably know it, but explain anyway with the skinny.
William Shatner is Admiral James T. Kirk, who's taking one last command on the Starship Enterprise, currently captained by Leonard Nimoy's Spock, to respond to a distress signal from science vessel Regula 1. But before arriving, the crew of mostly trainees are ambushed by Kirk's old rival, Khan, played by Ricardo Montalban.
Ricardo Montalban,
who is pursuing a nefarious plan to steal a dangerous terraforming device. A plan he will get back to once he's through settling a certain score with a certain starship admiral.
Admiral, there be Khans here. Anyway, in a nutshell, genetic freak initiates planetary miracle just to be spiteful. From hell's heart, I stab at thee, for hate's sake.
You know, for someone who's that familiar with Moby Dick, you think he maybe would have internalized the message of the book to not pursue revenge to your own end.
And also, he's a very intelligent person. He's a superhuman.
Yeah.
And that includes his brain, and yet, yes, he...
A project of eugenics from the 1990s.
So he's hundreds of years old then.
Okay, I know I'm jumping ahead here, but it's so dumb that a show that was made in the 60s, and of course the movie's made in the 80s, but the first episode that we see Khan in, Space Seed, aired in 1967, and they say, oh, he's from the 1990s when eugenics created superhumans. But he's clearly, at the very least, in his 40s, which would mean that eugenics, the experiments, would have had to take place in the 50s for him to have been alive in the 90s. It's just like this lazy writing. Just make it the 2030s or something, and then you got no problem.
Yeah. Well, don't forget 2001 was at one point a long way off, and a very famous movie title is what it became. And we've long since passed that now.
Okay, but 2001, which was made in the 60s, mm-hmm. if 2001 had a character in it who was in their 80s and was a product of genetic engineering, you would say, uh-uh, that's impossible, because I was alive when he was supposed to have been genetically engineered and the science did not exist. I can tell you right now. Anybody watching the series in the 60s could have done the math themselves, as I did, and immediately figured out that it was a mistake. I don't know why I'm picking on it. I loved the movie, guys.
That's a good point, but I think there's a conspiracy afoot here, and they actually have made superhumans. We just don't know about it.
Oh, okay, maybe you're right. They haven't taken over the planet yet, but, you know,
Gene Roddenberry knew something that we don't. Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers on Star Trek 2. 88% of critics liked the film, 45 fresh, only 6 rotten, and 90% of audiences, so damn good scores, although it's not even an 8 on the IMDb, just shy of it. Hard to believe, isn't it? I thought it was going to be the IMDb 250 when I started doing the research for this, but it's not even close. The movie was 6th at the 1982 U.S. box office. E.T., of course, was far and away number 1, and Tootsie, which we also covered, was number 2. You just said a minute ago, Bev, that Star Trek II was based on Space Seed from the original series, and Khan was stranded with his people for 15 years on, what's it called again?
Oh, shoot, something 5 or 6.
Seti Alpha 5, that's it. Seti Alpha 5. And as we discussed a few weeks ago on Return of the Jedi, the title originally was going to be Vengeance of Khan, and there are other things that was going to be called, but that was going to be called Vengeance, but they took that out because of Revenge of the Jedi, which also changed its title to Return of the Jedi, and I think they actually got lucky with this movie because Wrath of Khan is just a better title than Vengeance of Khan would have been.
Wrath is just a better word than revenge.
It's more pithy. Anyway, we've just discussed the movie for probably 5 or 10 minutes before we got into our usual, yeah. What did you think of it, Bev? But I'll ask you, what did you think of it?
Well, I would say Wrath of Khan is more than just a great Star Trek movie. It's just a great film. It's smart and fun and tight as a drum, and you don't have to be a Trek fan to get into it. It helps that I am a Trek fan, but I think it's just a great movie, period.
You have many times been watching The Next Generation on Saturdays and Sundays when I'm working night shifts, and you're just hanging on the couch with the dogs.
I love it so much. I can't defend it. The Next Generation, the TV show, which is my favorite. I'm a big Picard fan. It's one of the few shows from my childhood that I still hang on to and can't get enough of. I can watch it any day.
You don't have to apologize. I think most people that listen to this episode are going to be big fans of Trek as well. I like the movies, or most of them anyway. I'm not a huge fan of The Next Generation. I don't really know them that well. I've only seen some of those episodes. I haven't seen that many of the original series for that matter, but I certainly know them better and prefer the original series.
I mean, a lot of people like to draw lines and they say, well, you're a Star Wars fan or you're a Star Trek fan, but I think there is something kind of special about Star Trek, the whole world, which the movies betray a little bit and the shows are a little more loyal to, which is just such an unabashedly optimistic world, and they're not just optimistic about humans achieving peace amongst themselves, but it's deeply optimistic about the accomplishments of science, and there's this deep love and respect for science as a pursuit, embodied in a way by the illustration of the Genesis machine. There's rarely punishment for the hubris of advancement. There's no Terminator moments. Technology is always what helps them and what saves them. And there's also this tremendous respect for intelligence and problem solving.
Well,
there's,
hang on while you have that thought. The Enterprise is overhead right now.
I know, the technology of air travel is kiboshing
our podcast right now. Don't you go away, Kirk, Picard, or whoever's flying that
thing. Is, if Kirk or Picard were here right now, they would figure out a way with the help of their engineering staff to eliminate this sound distraction, and off it goes now.
Back to what you were saying, though.
I love Trek so much more. I can enjoy Star Wars. I can enjoy all these other action-y franchises, but there's something so delightfully cerebral about Star Trek, and it almost blends with the Twilight Zone aspect of creatively imagining what mysteries space holds or what mysteries the crew can solve. Often the plots are written in a mystery format where the evidence is doled out to you a bit at a time and you have to figure out with the crew how to solve the problem. They do that a little bit in Wrath of Khan, although I think it's more of a traditional action story and a great one, but just Star Trek in general. That's my enduring appeal of Star Trek angle, guys.
I like Star Trek. I've never been as big a fan as you are, obviously.
And I'm not even like a biggest fan. I feel like such a poser calling myself a huge fan because there are so many super devoted fans.
I'd be curious to see who, and how would you even know this, but who the number one fan for Star Trek actually is, and just how much money they've spent on memorabilia
somewhere there's like a battle of number one fans recreating that Kirk Spock battle with the music and those big, what do you call those weapons? I don't know, the staffs that they fight with.
Well, one thing about this movie, they can't reenact the Kirk and Khan fight because they never have a face-to-face scene. The reason why is because Ricardo Montalban was actually shooting this movie when he could fit in to do Fantasy Island, the TV show, so he had to jam this in when he possibly could, and I guess that didn't really work with Shatner's schedule. Somehow, anyway, they didn't have any scenes together. I don't know when they would have anyway. I suppose you could have had Khan go down to that planet where he strands Kirk momentarily, the infamous Khan screaming. Kirk is really only there with the other people for, I don't know, a few hours at the most. Maybe you could have a fight there, but they couldn't do it because Montalban wasn't around.
It would have made a great climax of the film to have them meet face-to-face, but as many times as I've seen this movie, I've never missed it. It's been described as a submarine film.
Yeah.
Because they truly are stuck in their vessels and they kind of have to outthink each other inside their own little world.
And that chase scene in the Matara Nebula is actually an homage to The Enemy Below, a sub-movie.
Yeah, that's right.
Dipping and dodging all over the place.
And all the thinking in 3D, right? Mm-hmm. One of the valid complaints about the film, although it never bothers me, is that Nebula scene, along with a couple others, is an illustration of how TV-ish some of the special effects were. Of course, it was 1982, so there's only so much anybody could do. But the special effects, they don't stand up compared to the Star Wars franchise. Mm-hmm. They do have that great shot. The first computer animated shot in a feature film ever, I think, which is the shot of the simulation of the Genesis machine terraforming a planet.
Right.
And it looks great, even by today's standards. I think it looks pretty cool.
I think so. Another plane going overhead, I think, possibly. This is now the Reliant flying overhead. So the movie's set in the 23rd century, 2285 to be specific. Kirk is 52 years old, but he feels young. At least at the end, he feels young.
He feels old at the beginning of the
film. They do very smartly play off this notion that he is somebody who should be getting close to retirement. Although at 52, why would you have to retire? But anyway, this movie does that. Voyage Home has some of that kind of stuff. I guess maybe they all do, come to think of it. But I know 2, 4, and 6, the best of the original movies. Like most people, I would say that the even-numbered ones are better than the odd-numbered ones.
The curse of the even-number films. Although, hasn't it been reversed now with the new franchise? The odd-number films are the better ones?
Oh, that could be true with the new ones, yeah. But that wasn't true about the Next Generation movies because...
Or Nemesis. Nemesis was the first one to really break the cycle, I think.
Okay, yeah. Sounds about right. But as far as Kirk feeling young, all it takes is excitement and fantasy to feel young again, or sex possibilities, I guess, with Carol Marcus.
I think it's him finding his purpose again. Like, that's what he was always meant to do, was to gallivant and explore the galaxy. He could never
excitement
really...
and fantasy, that's what I said.
Yeah, excitement and fantasy and being in charge of something and having purpose. That's where he's meant to be. You can't stick him in Starfleet Academy and expect him to thrive.
It's his first best destiny, as Spock says, to be commanding a starship. Well, the movie is also very progressive in this way. I'd never noticed until this viewing. The first voice is a woman, Savick, speaking because she's doing the Kobayashi Maru test.
Yeah, played by Kirstie Alley.
Right. The first face you see is a Vulcan / Romulan. That's Kirstie Alley. And the second face you see is Uhura, so a black woman. They all come in before you ever see Spock or before you ever see Kirk or anybody else on that bridge, although it's always been an integrated bridge. You've got a Russian, you've got an Asian in Sulu, you've got a black woman in Uhura, and Spock represents an alien, although he, of course, is just a regular old boring white guy in makeup, but still, it is a very integrated crew for the most part. And then you also got a Scotsman, of course, in the crew, too, so you have a nice diversity of a lot of different kinds of people. Although I suppose, and you'd know this better than me, the newer versions of all the TV shows are probably more diverse, I'm guessing. And, of course, you have a woman, Janeway, captaining the Enterprise? Or
Voyager.
Okay, but still, she is the head honcho.
Well, the new series that's coming out, I think the captain is a dude, but all the promos are really heavily featuring Michelle Yeoh, and I'll forget her name. She played Sasha in The Walking Dead, but a black woman and Asian woman are
Saniqua Martin Green, I believe.
There you go. But they're all over the trailer. It seems to almost be like it's exclusively their story. And if you look on IMDb and you look at the cast, made more and more progress. Although I wouldn't give Star Trek any awards for, especially because it's supposed to be portraying the future, especially the old series. I mean, granted, it was 67. Yeah, they had a handful of women in there, but their skirts were all the way up their butts, and they were, like, pretty, and they all had not-in-charge jobs.
Well, I've come to think about it, on the bridge in the original series, it was just Uhura, and maybe other people, background players.
Sure. There would be, like, other characters in the odd episode. And I have to confess, I actually don't know the original series all that well. Not as well as I know Next Generation, and even by 90s standards, Next Generation didn't really get that creative with ways to incorporate women in particular.
And the main cast is just two, the Doctor and
they're both healers. It's the Doctor and the Counselor.
Right, yeah.
Okay, wait, there's a security officer in season one who chose to leave the show.
Oh, okay. But through the run of the show, it's just the two of them. And what, five or six guys? So, yeah, never even. But the shows and the movies tried to be progressive more than most shows and movies did in the 60s and even in the 90s and sometimes even
He's trying to portray a perfect, peaceful future. You should be even more inclusive than they were.
Zarathicon has biblical themes as well. Genesis, of course, very biblical. Spock is effectively Jesus. He sacrifices himself and is reborn. Well, that's the next movie, which, by the way, is the best of the odd number movies. It's part of that three-episode arc.
Zarathicon,
Search for Spock, Voyage Home. And I like Search for Spock quite a bit. There's some really good stuff in there. In fact, they blow up the Enterprise. That's a pretty monumental thing to do. Although the Enterprise has been destroyed many times in the movie since, at least two other times now. But nevertheless, that was a monumental moment and a pretty good movie in bringing Spock back into the thing. It's funny, too, because Nimoy wanted out of Trek. Then he was excited to come back. I guess when he saw the screenplay, maybe when he saw the possibilities, he also demanded, well, maybe demanded is strong, but he wanted to direct three, and he did also direct four. But he at one time did not want to do Spock anymore, and he wrote a book, I Am Not Spock. I read the other book he wrote, I Am Spock.
Oh, good for him for ultimately embracing it. I can see how it would be hard as an actor to be associated with any one single character, but especially in a franchise that is so, you know, for lack of a better word, nerdy and niche and genre, and it could limit the other roles.
And the original show didn't even succeed. It didn't last more than, what was it, 3 years?
Yeah, I think it was canceled in the third season.
I think it was probably too expensive. And speaking of expensive, Gene Roddenberry was pushed out because of the big budget of the first movie. He was blamed for that, along with some script diddling he was doing. So Harv Bennett came in and was the executive producer. You've read online about this stuff. The actual credited producer, Robert Salen, his only movie credit as a producer, by the way, is never mentioned, really. It's all Harv Bennett who took over, and then he agreed to do the movie on a much smaller budget. He said he could do, what was it, five movies on the budget they did motion picture on, which are the first Trek movie, of course. And that's why they have reused sets, reused costumes. The bridge of the Enterprise is also used for the Reliant. They just turn it upside down or something, and they have all kinds of scenes on those two bridges. So a ton of the movie is set in the spaceship. Didn't have to cost that much money.
They're Starfleet spaceships. So, of course, they would be similar. It's not that much of a stretch. Considering it probably had one of the smallest budgets of any of the Star Trek films, it's still the best one, without question. I think that right there is your example of what's more important than special effects. Well, script, characters, good acting, and solid, competent directing, just like a good helm of the ship. Sorry for that particular metaphor. But you can make a great film, even a great science fiction film, for a smaller budget. The special effects are great, and of course you enjoy them, but God, I don't need to tell anybody who's a film fan that Hollywood has become way too heavily reliant on special effects to carry a film, rather than, for God's sake, take that million and pay somebody who knows what they're doing to do a great pass of your script.
And this movie does have a very good screenplay. It sets up the Kobayashi Maru in the beginning, and it plays it out beautifully in the end. What do you think of my solution, Jim? It's great. It makes perfect sense. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. He says that earlier on, then he actually lives up to it. And then, of course, that's played out nicely in three, where the needs of the one outweigh the needs of the many. But there's also a misdirect at the beginning, because they kill everybody in the simulation with what look like real explosions. You gotta wonder, somebody's not staying in the exact
it's
right
like
place.
The most dangerous training mission ever.
Yeah, exactly. But that's done, apparently, because the word got out somehow, this is long before the internet, that Spock was going to die in the movie. So then you see the scene where he and everybody, apart from Kirk, of course, who's watching them do this, dies, and then it's the whole thing where people sitting there think, well, they were wrong, he doesn't die, they pretend he died.
I never heard that, but that makes so much sense. I mean, of course I heard notoriously that somebody leaked that Spock dies in the movie, and the fans were outraged, they demanded that they should change the script, their whole experience was going to be ruined, but what a clever way to get around it is to have him fake die in the beginning.
People said that back then, what would they do now?
Oh my God, Trek fans are the original troll fans. The original annoying, know every detail, impossible, give such a hard time to the creators fans.
Where's the error lie in that? Galaxy Quest.
Okay. I was thinking of that episode of The Simpsons where they're doing it, although it's with Itchy and Scratchy, but with like
same
comic
idea,
book
though.
Man. Oh, yeah, yeah. Impossible. Like, if you love this show so much, why
can't you just
be...
No, it's not comic book guy you're thinking of. You're thinking of the nerds that Homer befriends.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right. And he's like, how can he play the same note twice? And if a fruit cage is a xylophone.
So back to Rathacon. It's got Navy themes, too, and the director, Nicholas Meyer, did that again in episode 6. He also rewrote the screenplay uncredited, and if we're going to say it's a good screenplay, credit has to go to him, although the actual writer credited was Jack Sowards, his only movie credit. A lot of people behind the scenes, this is their only actual movie. It's surprising. I think they would have a lot more. Or the technical people didn't do another Star Trek movie. The cinematographer, the editor, didn't work on a Star Trek movie again that I could see anyway online. All right, so Admiral Kirk, who of course is the star, although a lot of people would say that Spock relates, but anyway, he knows how to game the system, cheating at the Kobayashi Maru, which they discuss. We don't see that happen, of course. And then he drops the Reliance shields, part of the reason why he's such a great starship captain, or admiral in this case. But has Kirk got a death wish? He had nothing anyway when he goes out on this training mission. And then when he finds out he's got to spring back into action, what's he got to lose?
He is notoriously cheating death. He doesn't want to accept that he's aging. He's troubled by the new class of Starfleet Academy kids coming in to replace him. He's forced to wear reading glasses, and he's not thrilled at all about the fact that his best years are behind him, and of course, fearing death. We learn halfway through the film that the only reason that he beat the Kobayashi Maru test is because he cheated, and the Kobayashi Maru test is a no-win scenario. It's meant to test the mettle of these students to see what do they do in a situation where they know all hope is lost and they're all going to die. Reveal your character when the worst-case scenario has happened. And he avoids the worst-case scenario. Like, he avoids death. He fears aging. He fears death. But as you say, he puts himself in danger. He risks death all the time. Although that's a common contradiction with people who are risk-takers. They embrace death as a way to constantly prove to themselves they're invincible.
He's rolling the dice with everyone else's life, but then he's such a great captain or admiral, so maybe that's
why. Always his way. He's like a cowboy captain, right? He's like the science fiction cowboy.
And how about Spock's quick thinking? Just goes right down there, nerve pinches the doctor. And McCoy also is being a little bit of an idiot. If Spock's saying, I'm going to go in there and fix the dilithium crystals, or whatever the hell it is he's got to fix so they can get the warp drive working so they can get the hell out of there when the Genesis device goes off on the Reliant, why would you stop him? They're all going to die, or maybe he dies only. And as it turns out, he is the only one that dies. Well, other people probably did, too. Earlier on, they had, actually, when Khan attacked. But in that situation, he's the only other one that dies.
Because McCoy is giving in to his human instincts to save his friend, whereas Spock, the rational, logical one, knows enough to choose the lives of many over the life of one, himself. But he has to overcome all these humans with their weak emotions so he can not just do the right thing, but to do the logical thing.
And he does that kata move on McCoy, too. Remember.
Which was an ad later. I don't even know if they shot it at the time or if they threw all this in. They were going to have him just die and that was going to be the end of it. But then producers thought the story's so good we might want to come back to it. And Nimoy was having such a good time on set, really loving revisiting the character, that he agreed that he may want to come back as Spock. So they set up this little, what is it, remember.
Yeah.
Gives his consciousness to him.
And the big bad, Khan, so Khan Noonien Singh is his full name, he quotes Moby Dick a lot, and in episode 6, also directed by Nicholas Meyer, Christopher Plummer is quoting Shakespeare all the time, so that's a Meyer thing, I guess, to go back to the great writers of all time. And in the whole movie, but especially in the end, the big Dick Khan falls to big Dick taunts from Kirk.
He's super smart, he's super strong, but he's also super proud, and that is his downfall.
And he has maybe a super ego, if you will.
He does have a super ego, thank you, Ryan.
I just mentioned great writers. One other one is Chekhov, not the guy from Star Trek, but was it Antony or something? Anyway, the Russian guy from many centuries ago, or whenever it was, a long time ago. This movie is a great example of Chekhov's gun theory, that if you set up, there's a gun in the opening act, it has to go off by at least the last act.
And this, of course,
is the Genesis device. Yeah, and then the no-one situation, and also the needs of the many, quote. But then when that's happening, and the starship is finally getting away very slowly, not fast enough until the warp drive is fixed, it reminded me of the funny line in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, I guess it is. Run away, run away. Because that's the great thing. They have this battle and they're shooting at each other. But in the end, Khan wins, or he would win, if they weren't able to just run away.
Yeah. The Genesis device is also like a great metaphor that fits in with the theme of aging and being replaced. Because it's an incredible device that can create life out of absolutely nothing.
It's supposed to actually terraform an existing planet. But yes, it actually creates it out of, I guess, that nebula and the Reliant ship. Mm-hmm.
But in its act of creating new life, it destroys everything in its path, which is just like these new cadets coming in, breathing new life into Starfleet, but replacing the old crew. The first motion picture, they just tried to pretend that the actors hadn't aged, and act like everything was normal. This time, I guess the producers decided there's no hiding it. These actors are older. Let's just address it. Shatner had a problem with that. He actually wasn't comfortable with playing an aging Kirk who was uncomfortable with it. He wanted to play the same, like, swashbuckling Captain Kirk he had always played. But they talked him into it, and he does a great job. I'm a Picard girl, but I get why people love Captain Kirk. He's just such a great, confident cowboy hero, and he's just so watchable and charismatic. He's a good actor in this role, and he convincingly plays that fear and that malaise with his place in the world and his revival when he gets into the action of it again.
This is his best work in any Trek movie, but in this trilogy, 2, 3, and 4, he has the great moment in 3 where it's, well, I guess it's overplayed, but you killed my son. Klingon bastard, you killed my son. He plays that pretty well. And then in 4, it's more about humor, and he and Nimoy are very funny together. Not that they're not funny in some of the other movies, but they're not really that laugh-out-loud humorous. In 4, they certainly are, including that whole bit in the pickup truck with the whale doctor.
They have, like, a great natural comedic dyad because they're total polar opposites.
Well, a triad, because McCoy is always part of
it. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's absolutely true, too. But Kirk and Spock is total opposite people, where Kirk is all instinct and machismo and bravado, also very smart, but Spock is the totally rational, down-to-earth one who always does a smart thing and makes a smart decision and always raises his eyebrow in that smug judgment of every move that Kirk makes.
You green-blooded inhuman, whatever the line is. Eyebrow raised. Now, as for the Genesis planet at the end, if we keep up at our current pace, we'll need Genesis to make us a new planet.
Yeah.
Or we're going to go to Mars, actually, is what Trump wants us to do. Well, actually, the Genesis planet's very unstable as well, because in 3, it flat out explodes before they get Spock's young body off of there and get him back to Vulcan to put his Kata inside of McCoy back into Spock's body, which is a really bizarre thing. It doesn't make a ton of sense, but it's sci-fi. If Shatner's great in these movies, of course Nimoy is too. I like that the captain, because Spock is the captain of the ship, goes down properly without his ship. There's always that saying about how the captain goes down with his ship. Well, he dies, but the ship and the crew move on. DeForest Kelly as McCoy did more TV than movies, quite a bit more actually, and he's most proud of his work in Westerns. He's one of those guys you don't think of as a Western star, but in his mind he was. Now, Ricardo Montalban, we've talked about him a lot already, but how about the chest? There's all that stuff online I'm sure you read about. It wasn't his actual chest, it was a prosthetic.
But it was his chest.
Nicholas Meyer says it really was, and he worked out a lot. He looked like he was in very good shape, so it could have been. It doesn't really make a difference, and yet there's so many entries on the IMDb, and I think on Wikipedia, about this, as if it's some big deal that he had a fake chest or a real one.
It's not that hard to believe that a man his age could just be that fit.
Well, they would be now. Most guys are that fit, unless you want to be Anthony Hopkins and let yourself age gracefully, or Nicholson. Most people who are in their 50s even are in great shape. Certainly the young guys are the Ryan Reynolds stereotype. Chris Pratt, we just saw Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 last night.
Yeah.
He's got one topless scene. He had to have at least one, and he still is very bulky. And okay. I don't mean the old Chris Pratt bulky. I mean the ripped Chris Pratt.
And I think the bigger star, bigger than his chest, is the shirt. Mm-hmm. The shirt that's so delicately cut to expose his boobs. And he wears this Starfleet emblem around his neck, and I think it's implied that his wife, he keeps talking about his wife that he lost, is supposed to be a crew member of the Enterprise that went with him when he was exiled.
Right.
He never says it explicitly, they never say her name, but I assume that that's the case.
She wasn't a superhuman like they are, so I guess maybe that's why she died. Although, doesn't he say at one point that the parasites that they put into Chekhov and, what's his name, Captain Terrell, Paul Winfield, their ears, that's what killed off his wife
does.
And a lot of
other people. He does say that, yeah.
Okay, right. They are in a hellhole, but then it wasn't intentional that SETI Alpha 5 was so bad to live on. It was because of the explosion of the sun or SETI Alpha 6, one of those two things that knocked it out of orbit. Although you think, how is the planet livable in any way if that happens? But it's a sci-fi movie. Khan is a man-made god who wants Genesis so he can play God. I like that touch too. As I said, a lot of biblical themes in this movie.
Something they don't get into in the episode far more than the movie when they introduce Khan as a character is that in the 90s when he was a product of eugenics, he was actually a conqueror on Earth. He is called Khan because he kind of resembles Genghis Khan. That level of success, and eventually he was overthrown and sent into space. They talk a great deal in the episode about the eugenics wars of the 1990s and that it was this horrible time in human history and that people like Khan are one of the people responsible for it. So having seen the episode and then watching the movie again, it's much better set up for understanding his ambitions and what kind of person he thinks he is. He truly does see himself like a god or like somebody who's so far superior to everyone else in the human race that he's right to take whatever he wants. He's right to pursue conquering the universe, and he's right to sacrifice every member of his own crew, people that he's been with for the last 15 years, in pursuit of revenge.
Even though Montalban's a little bit over the top, I think maybe it would have been nice to see him get an Oscar nomination as supporting actor. It would have been a pleasant surprise.
I mean, I guess he chews scenery, but I love every second of his performance. And, you know, they say, like, a great action movie or a great adventure movie has to have a great villain. And he is one of the best things about the movie and one of the things that makes it stand out from all the other Star Trek movies.
Even though the Klingons are generally the best villains in the history of Star Trek, or maybe the Borg.
I vote Borg.
Okay, you're a Next Generation person. But the single best villain, as far as I'm concerned, is definitely Khan in the entire lexicon of Star Trek. The other actors, James Doohan, Walter Koenig, apparently it's pronounced Koenig, George Takei, and Nichelle Nichols, we know their roles, of course, they've been doing these movies, or were doing these movies for so long. Some of these people are dead now, I forget which. Takei is still alive, for sure, and I think maybe Nichelle Nichols is.
I heard Shatner Takei still is going to run for Congress.
Okay.
Or run for office, I should say.
Great tweeter.
Oh, yeah.
Very funny guy.
He's had this renaissance in the last 5 years, developing a presence on the internet and also being an outspoken supporter of LGBTQ rights and coming out himself very late in life. There was a great documentary. What was it called? To Be Decay? Or...
I think that's it, yeah.
Yeah, I can't recommend it highly enough. He's such a charismatic character, and so is his husband. Oh, my God. Amazing and hilarious.
I think it's still on Netflix. That's how we saw it when it first came out. I think it was on New Year's Day a few years ago. We watched it the day it came out. It's funny to look at their resumes, these people doing Koenig, Takei, and Nichols, and I guess even DeForest Kelly, not so much Nimoy and Shatner, but at this point in 82, and then certainly in the later 80s and into the 90s, almost every credit they have is Star Trek related, especially movies. They did TV shows sometimes, but...
You can have a worse career, there's no doubt about that. Mm. I can see how it could be frustrating, but compared to the lives of most working actors. And these are such beloved characters, how could you complain about that?
They must have made a ton of money off of... merchandising rights and that kind of stuff anyway, and lived well enough. I mean, they were definitely retirement age people around this time or not that long after. Shatner's still working now, and he's done some other great stuff. T.J. Hooker maybe isn't great, but it was a successful show in its time. And then he got into Boston Legal, and I think he won some Emmys or Golden Globes, or was certainly nominated for them.
And he had something of a film career as well. He certainly made some movies. I hear he's a total piece of work. I think George Takei wrote a book in the 90s that was about his experience on Star Trek, but it really revolved around what a dick Shatner was.
The only person who wasn't at Takei's wedding of the main cast was
like
Shatner.
Nobody liked him. There's this notorious story that I heard from people who worked in Toronto. He was in American Psycho 2, which of course you've never seen because nobody has. These friends of mine worked on it, and they said that there was a PA who notoriously, when he was driving Shatner to the airport, got so mad at him, was so fed up after months of being tormented by him on set, that he kicked him out of the car in the middle of Highway 427, which is a high volume, a fast-moving highway in Toronto. And I just love that story, but then I also love that somewhere in this city is someone with a story about picking up a hitchhiker that turned out to be William Shatner.
Can you give me a ride?
I have a plane to catch.
The other two major actors in the film are Bebe Besh and Merritt Buttrick. Bebe Besh is Carol Marcus. She was in Steel Magnolias and Tremors after this and a lot of other things. She didn't want to come back. That's why she wasn't in any of the sequels. But Merritt Buttrick was in Star Trek III. This was his debut, though. How did he not become a superstar with a name like Merritt Buttrick? And I shouldn't speak ill of the dead because he did die in 1989, way too young in life. And they're fine in the film. Nothing outstanding. But his death scene in 3 is pretty important. It actually comes back to haunt Kirk in 6. That's the whole plot line. Because he's still pissed at the Klingons for having killed my son, you Klingon bastards.
I'm curious about why Kirstie Alley didn't come back to do her role as Savick. Because, I mean, by all reports, she liked working in the film. She liked doing her character. Did she get Cheers around that time or something?
No, that was in the late 80s when Shelley Long left. And this is only 82. Search for Spock was 84. She could have come back into that one.
Because she was recast with a different actress.
Yeah. Robin something. I forget her name now. But yeah, she was in that movie. And then the character that's in 6, Kim Cattrall, who ends up being, spoiler alert, but Star Trek 6 is 26 years old, and we say we spoil movies, so she ends up being one of the villains. She's in on the whole thing. That should have been Savick, and it would have made sense, too, because Savick is part Romulan. That's why she cries. That's why she gets emotional. That's why she seems to be upset when Scotty brings his, what you learn in the deleted scenes, nephew onto the bridge, because she actually knew that guy, and she's just upset that somebody's died. But a Vulcan shouldn't get visibly upset. She does. Several times in this film.
I mean, Vulcans and their lack of emotion is truly like a cultural thing, that they control their emotions and they choose to be rational and logical.
And the new movie, Spock, is battling that because he's still younger. I guess that's the idea.
He's also half human.
Right. But he's half human in this version, too, in any of the Leonard Nimoy TV shows and movies. I'm just saying that as he got older, you could argue that he learned how to control it. And as the Zach Quinto version, he's still learning how to master that.
because all Vulcans kind of have to learn how to master that.
Okay.
Romulans are essentially genetically Vulcans that chose to leave the planet Vulcan because they hated all their restrictive and repressive emotion controlling.
One more thing I want to say about Merritt Buttrick as David. This movie in some ways is Empire Strikes Back light because there's a revelation that a major character is a father.
I am your father.
Judson Scott is unbilled. He's the guy who plays Khan's second in command. And the reason why he's unbilled, and he didn't have much of a career for this either, he didn't do very many more movies, is his agent. It was all that guy's fault. He wanted better billing for his client, and then he ended up getting no billing at all.
Oh my God, I didn't even know that could happen.
And most, or at least a lot, of the Khan people, the guys, are Chippendale dancers, which is why they're in such great shape. And they don't really have, I think, any lines, so it doesn't matter that they can't act that well. They don't need to act.
That's the 80s, where you had to go to Chippendale dancers to find men that were in shape. Now, I don't think any guy would even bother trying to make it in Hollywood unless he was fit like that.
Well, look at Chris Pratt. Like I said before, he was not fit. He gets into Guardians of the Galaxy, and suddenly he's Mr. Fit as well, even though he was known as Fat Pratt. He's called himself that.
And he always says, oh, Fat Pratt's coming back. He's still here inside me.
I love to eat. The director, Nicholas Meyer, of course, did Episode 6 as well, and he wrote The 7% Solution in, I think, the 70s, so that is Sherlock Holmes. This guy's involved with a lot of classic characters, at least weaves them in with Shakespeare and Moby Dick, and then writing a Holmes movie. He's one of four men to direct two Star Wars movies. Do you know who the other ones are? I think I mentioned one already.
Oh, gosh.
We've talked about him a lot already. Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah,
he did Episodes 3 and 4. Now he only directed 5. Episode 5, that is.
Oh.
Jonathan Frakes did 2 of them, and J.J. Yeah. Abrams, of course, has done 2,
I think, only. I didn't realize you were talking about the whole spectrum. I forgot about that.
No one's directed 3 movies, I don't believe. We talked about the writers and producers already, but one more note about Gene Roddenberry, who was an executive on this, at least. This was his original idea with the show. It's one of the landmark creations in the history of television and into movies. It's too bad he didn't get to enjoy the success a little bit more. He died, I think, the year that they released Episode 6. There's a tribute to him in that one. He did create something pretty damn important. Not quite on the level of George Lucas with Star Wars, but not that far behind it either.
And I think that the fans of Star Trek, maybe a little fewer. Obviously, there's fewer fans of Star Trek than Star Wars, but I think they have the same devotion as Star Wars fans. And I think that Roddenberry had this, I guess it's not a unique vision, his optimism for the future, but he had this combination of this beautiful optimism in the future, this curiosity about space and exploration, and also like a really great instinct for creating characters. And we should be grateful for his legacy. Obviously, it makes a lot of people, including me, pretty happy.
Well, he did things like have the first interracial kiss in the history of TV when Shatner kissed Nichelle Nichols in one episode. And of course, you mentioned Shatner and Nimoy while Kirk and Spock fight at one point. And all kinds of iconic things that people still talk about now. And the series has been gone for 50 or so years.
And you could credit Roddenberry with almost creating an entire genre the way you can credit George Romero with creating the zombie films as they are today. I think Star Trek films embody this whole beautiful, specific world that people love. This will be the 5th or 6th unique series, the new one, Discovery, Star Trek Discovery.
It's got to be. There was Voyager, there was Deep Space Nine, there was the Next Generation, there's the original series.
Maybe it's six, but it's at least five. Star Trek Enterprise, Star Trek Discovery.
Yeah. And I bet there's some fans listening to this saying, there's actually been 7 or 8, you morons.
I know, I could be wrong about that.
The problem with us covering movies like this and even the Star Wars films and some of the iconic movies that have so many nerd fans, I don't mean that in a disparaging way because I associate with you guys, but we don't know nearly enough.
Oh my God, there's podcasts dedicated simply to every single episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, you know, that cover every single episode of that show the same way we cover movies. There are many, many dedicated fans who probably won't even bother with us because they know everything that we just told you.
We are simpletons.
Yeah.
Okay, technically speaking, the movie's 2, 3, 5, 2, 1. We watched the Blu-ray, which I bought not long before we had to watch the movie. Looks all right. Cinematographer was Gain Rescher. His first movie was A Face in the Crowd. A pretty important movie, especially when you look at the way Trump has gone. That was back in the 50s. And Andy Griffith, of all people, plays a bit of a bad guy, rabble-rouser politician. The editor was William Dornish. He only cut a few movies and did some MacGyvers on TV. But the most famous behind-the-scenes person out of all these guys would be James Horner, who later did Aliens, Field of Dreams, Titanic, a lot of stuff with James Cameron, actually, and so many more. He's one of the great composers. He's probably in the top 20 or 25, at least, of all-time great composers. Maybe not quite top 10. But he came up with some of the stuff you still hear in the music now. Jerry Goldsmith had done the music for the first one, and I think he was just too expensive, and they wanted to go a different route. So let's go with this new kid.
They caught him on his way up.
And he wrote a pretty iconic score.
Yeah, it is a great score. It's incredible.
They based a lot of it on the original series music. A Okay, there's plenty of influence. I guess you got to start with the sequels, prequels, and remakes, including Into Darkness, where Benedict Cumberbatch plays Khan. That was a secret that was impossible to keep from getting out, and it was kind of pointless to make it a big secret. Let's let him be Khan. People were excited to think he would be. It's Spock who yells, Khan! At one point.
I mean, they just betray the whole Vulcan everything. They do it in the old, in the original series, too, but in the new ones, the idea that he's rational and logical, they just blow it up.
The early episodes of the original series, I believe, they're still working on the Vulcan thing with the emotions. He does smile and laugh. Spock does. That's what I've heard. I don't think I've ever seen any of those episodes. I've only seen, if I didn't say this already, some episodes of the original series here and there. I've heard about them so much, though. It's one of those things you have to watch it to know about it kind of deal, you know? And by the way, speaking of the younger actors in these newer movies, they're better actors in general, but are they better for the characters? I don't know. Maybe because I'm hung up on the original actors and I've seen these movies so many times. I don't know if any of them are better than the actor that they're replacing. And I've never been a big fan, even though I like Chris Pine, of him playing Kirk. I don't think he's that great in the role. People think Carl Urban's awesome as Bones. I think he's okay. Quinto is the best thing of the main cast.
Yeah, he's perfect casting. They could never have found a better Spock. He totally kills it.
So they're more talented actors and they've done better movies, but I don't know that they're right for their roles.
So I like Chris Pine as Kirk, but I think he plays it a little tongue-in-cheek just because he's a bit of a goof. That's his nature. But you have to agree that Simon Pegg as Scotty is some kick-ass casting.
I'm not sure he's right in comparison to the character he's playing. It's okay that they're different. They have to be different. They're not the same people. It's many years after the original movies came out. I've never been as big a fan as other people, especially the very first one. I definitely liked Into Darkness, and I haven't seen Beyond a second time, but I mean to.
I really love the first movie, the first, I should say, reboot movie the most, and I enjoyed the other two movies, but I agree with you, and I'll repeat what I said earlier, where I really think that the movies, and especially the new movies, betray the spirit of Star Trek. Because they aren't about being intellectual. They aren't about being diplomatic and trying to find peaceful solutions rather than war. They're not about solving mysteries. They're just tentpole action films. They just took a Marvel film and gave it Star Trek characters. And they're really fun movies, and I totally enjoy them. But they blend in with all the other summer action fare, and I find especially the second and third one completely forgettable. The second we saw it with a couple of friends.
And they were tearing it down along with you.
And we were like, that was great.
I walked out loving it.
This was stupid. That was stupid.
You guys ruined it for me.
I didn't mean to ruin it for you, but it ruins itself.
Well, you weren't wrong.
Being dumb, and it just wasn't a good enough movie to overcome the problems, the mistakes it made, the stuff I didn't care about. And I know there's probably plenty of people that disagree with me and enjoyed it, and I wouldn't want to take that away from them. But it's a Star Trek property, but it isn't in the Star Trek spirit.
Maybe that's the J.J. Abrams effect, because he is one of the ultimate nerds who's made it in Hollywood. Just like Spielberg in his day was one of the ultimate nerds and happened to be a rich and successful person. But he might have been an internet person if he never made it in films.
And I will say,
being a nerd about Star Trek.
Yeah, there's enough movies like that already. This is the thing, is most movies that come out, most big summer blockbusters look like that, sound like that, feel like that. So why would you give us another one when you could give us a proper Star Trek movie and let us indulge that thing that we don't get to see enough of? Part of the reason why Star Trek is so successful is because there really aren't a lot of things that are action-y, but more cerebral.
Yeah.
And that's what I think the fans love about it. The new movies don't really give that to us, but it's okay because they're fun, and there's so much like fun old properties to keep going back to over and over again and enjoy for what they are.
All right, moving on back to Wrath of Khan and influences. Of course, the Moby Dick theme, which is also in Jaws. There's even stronger comparisons to Moby Dick in the Jaws book. I'd say the best Star Trek movie is actually Galaxy Quest. I mentioned that earlier. It's one of my favorite comedies of all time, and it definitely loves Star Trek, even though it's poking a lot of fun at it, including at Shatner especially, but I think it's the best one.
It's incredibly affectionate, and affectionate towards Star Trek fans.
Yeah. They're the heroes.
Yeah,
Justin Long, his debut, just like Kirstie Alley's debut was Wrath of Khan and Merritt Butterick. Well, that was Justin Long's first movie, and it's still probably his best performance. He is so great as Brandon. Okay, the awards and list section didn't have any Oscar nominations. Not really that much of a surprise. And I mentioned Montalban, but it is so unusual for an actor in a sci-fi or horror movie or any kind of genre to get nominated. Sigourney Weaver, a few years later for Aliens, was one of the few ever at that time, and there haven't been that many since. I mean, Heath Ledger winning for The Dark Knight is still a bit of a surprise, even though we all agree he should have. It's a bit of a surprise he did, because it is very much a genre movie. Comic book, specifically, of course. Star Trek II Wrath of Khan was nominated for the Top 100 Thrills, the Top 100 Genres in the Sci-Fi category, of course, and the Top 50 Villains with Khan. I've said a lot of people should have made the villains list on the History of Our podcast that didn't, so I don't know if I can cram any more in there. I think Khan probably deserved it. They should have had 100 villains, I guess, and 100 heroes. Do two separate lists. And speaking of things this movie probably should have been nominated for would be the quotes list. Where was the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few? Or even, of all the souls I've encountered in my many travels, his was the most human.
Don't you think that Spock would have hated that eulogy?
Probably, but it's still great for a fan. And I have watched his death and that funeral scene on YouTube many, many times late at night when I've had a few too many beverages. And it can get pretty emotional sometimes because it's great by all of them. They're all wonderful in that moment. And here's this guy who gave of himself his life.
There's all these moments that on paper or when they're repeated by dummies like us, they sound so corny. But in the movie, they're all very much earned. In particular, I'm thinking of when that moment happens and William Shatner looks to the sky and yells,
"Buried alive!"
It's earned. Like, it doesn't actually seem hokey at all.
I agree. People have mocked it, but out of context, it's easier to mock than in context because it does make a lot of sense. And he should be upset. He should be yelling because, for all he knows, he's never going to get out of there. Although he and Spock do have that clever thing where they talk about hours and days, how long they're going to have to be on, and they get beamed aboard.
And, of course, like, another big staple of Star Trek is the way that they can just think their way out of any problem. Like MacGyver, their way to solve any problem that they're presented with, which they certainly do in Wrath of Khan.
All right, but then the last thoughts on Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Oh, if you're a Star Trek fan or not, you can totally enjoy this film. I will definitely be watching it again, and it kind of makes me want to revisit other films in the series.
I think the one with the whales is my favorite in general, but this is the best Star Trek film. I think it lives up to what Trek stood for in the original series, and it's more emotional than any silly sci-fi movie has any right to be.
Like I said, it's just a great standalone film. It's a great script, great cast, it's directed well.
And being part of that three-episode arc wasn't necessary. It just made it even more powerful, I guess, in the end, that it actually had a point to bring Spock back to life, and then the fourth one go back and save the entire planet Earth, and then they're heroes, so they're forgiven for their sins of what they do in three, as it turns out.
And once again, the Enterprise is flying low overhead and making some noise.
Fitting as we come to the end here, yeah. All right, next week we'll be 7 days closer to the summer, so let's heat things up with a strange romantic mystery. It's Dana Andrews macking on Gene Tierney in Laura. Okay, the coming attraction trivia for Laura. It's renowned for its music. In fact, it was 7th on AFI's list of the top 25 music scores. Yet David Raxon's tunes didn't even receive an Oscar nomination in 1944. Isn't that hard to believe? How many other pictures in the top 25 music scores didn't get an Oscar nomination for their music in that year? And there is more than just Laura.
All right, so for the answer to that, please tune into next week's podcast about Laura. And in the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. And while you're there, check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered over 200 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. And while you're there, rate us, review us. It helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
Remember.
And cut.